This is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development, featuring myself and my co-host, the Sonny and Cher of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 30. It's Saturday, December 8th, 2012, and our topic this week is cocoa bindings. And by presumably my rant about cocoa bindings, if not more than one rant, we'll see how it goes. So a little bit of follow-up from me. So apparently at the beginning of the last episode, I said, in episode 29, I said it was December 22nd instead of December 2nd. And I actually know why I did that now, which is because I actually wrote December 22 in my notes. I apparently typed the 2 twice. So that's something that's unlikely to happen much of the time, simply because, you know, you type 4-4, well, no one's going to mistake that for an actual date, right? So hopefully that won't happen again. Sorry for any confusion that might have caused.
Can you just fire the guy who writes your notes?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, yeah. I hear he has another job already, so, you know. Yeah. And then, not exactly follow-up, but something, a bit of an announcement for Edge Cases. We will be going on holiday break for the next 3 weekends. So we normally record on Saturday. So for the next 3 Saturdays, Saturday the 15th, the 22nd, there is actually the 22nd, and the 29th of December, there will be no episodes for you all. So I hope that all of our listeners also enjoy their holidays during that time period and don't miss us too badly. Just keep up your subscriptions in iTunes and you will get the next episode, which will presumably be on the 5th of January, 2013, when we release it.
I personally hope that our listeners don't enjoy their holidays because they'll be without us.
Yes. Well, I would say they could listen to the earlier episodes if they have to catch up, but I wouldn't necessarily subject them to our earlier episodes. The topics are fine, but I go back and listen to like me and my, you know, my intros for those. And it's so slow and it's, you know, it's just, it's got lots of reverb because it was just using the microphone from the laptop. And it's just painful to listen to the starts of them. Maybe once they got going, it was better, but I would probably steer people to other podcasts before our, you know.
I think we're the only show that criticizes ourselves like this. don't listen to our older episodes.
Hopefully our older episodes are the edge cases of the edge cases.
There we
podcast.
Go. Yes. Yeah, this is the prime time, baby. This is as good as it gets, sadly.
So, and we're still, we still have to work on that intro music that I want to add in. So. All right, so with that settled and our well wishes to everyone or non-well wishes, as the case may be, let's get going. Okay, so cocoa bindings. We've got sort of this pattern where we kind of go over the beginnings of a technology and then give our own opinions of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do some of that, but I'm also maybe not going to do too much of that because presumably cocoa bindings having been out for a bunch of years now, you've all, at the very least, heard about it and probably used some of it.
I would imagine that probably iOS developers haven't, but for jumping right in.
So that's kind of where it gets a little interesting. So cocoa bindings being built on top of 3 technologies: key-value coding, key-value observing, and key-value binding. The first 2 pieces of that, which are foundation-level technologies, are available on iOS. So it makes sense to talk about that a little bit, even if most of our listeners are iOS developers. So I was looking into this, reading blog posts, reading documentation about it, and there's one post from Cocoa with Love, and I'll put a link to the show notes to this. It was a 2010 post where he says the NS key value coding protocol has been in Cocoa since macOS 10.0. Mm. Did you know that? Had you ever noticed that header?
I believe KVC predates macOS 10, but I could be wrong about that.
Really? So it was something that came from Next?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I didn't know that it was earlier. And also, when I went to look at the NS key value coding.h header, there were 2 things that stood out to me. One is that the methods that it adds to NS object are still an informal protocol. Now, of course, they were an informal protocol before, what was it, Lion or Tiger, whatever it was, that added the ability to add optional protocol methods to protocols, such that you no longer had to make protocols informal in order to make sure that you didn't have to implement every single one of the methods. And what's happened, at least at the CoCo level, is they've turned almost all of those informal protocols into formal protocols. I was under the impression that that didn't really change much in terms of binary compatibility for classes. So it's interesting to me that the key value coding protocol is still informal. And I would be interested if anybody has any knowledge about any kind of backwards compatibility issues that I'm not aware of as to why that would still be. Okay, so that's the first thing.
Yeah, that almost sounds like an oversight. But if everything else got caught in the net, why didn't that? That's interesting.
Well, they might have just... So, yeah, I mean, it could be that they just, you know, just, yeah, an oversight, basically an oversight. They didn't get around to it. There were more important things to do at that point. Or there's just something we don't know about. So again, I'd be curious to find out. The other thing is that the methods in that .h file are massively commented. There's like paragraphs explaining all the details of it. Now, that's something that I've noticed between the different headers of various different modules, whatever you want to call them, of the various Apple APIs, is that the difference in style between these headers is often quite vast. And I believe that that's because these comments are by the teams themselves, the teams that wrote the code, as opposed to being done by separate documentation teams. Now, all the documentation you read on the website and that comes with Xcode, that's all done by separate teams. That's not done by the developers themselves. Obviously, it would be a big extra task for them to be writing paragraphs and paragraphs, pages and pages of documentation, so they don't do that. But I believe they write the headers. And so that means that there's room for quite a bit of difference in style. And, well, I mean, they're written by the teams, but they are still vetted by other people. So to make sure that you don't say anything that's not professional, for example, which... I have a funny story that I don't remember all the details about something like that. So maybe you remind me in another episode. I'll have those details together. But okay. In any case, what I'm thinking here is that these paragraphs and paragraphs are definitely not the style that I've ever seen in earlier headers that came from 10.0 or 10.1 or anything like that, because everything was very sparse back in those old days. So I would say that even if this mechanism existed prior to 10.3, when the whole CoCo bindings was introduced, as far as I understand it, they probably added the comments at the same time as they revamped the technology for the sake of CoCo bindings. That sound about right?
I would imagine so. Okay.
So now there is a document called Key Value Coding Programming Guide that comes from Apple, and I would recommend anyone who needs a refresher on KVC. Actually, did I start with that? So, again, the three sections, did I mention the three?
You did, yeah. Okay. You already hit KVC, you talked about KVO and KVB.
Fix it in post. Okay, so the Key Value Coding Programming Guide is just for the KVC portion. And so it's very, very useful. It's multiple sections in it. It's got examples, everything else. So it's a great thing to read through. This is, and I believe this came out when CoCo Bindings came out. So this was the point, I think, where Apple started to document things better overall. Now, I tended to think of the era when Apple documented its technologies better to start pretty much with iOS, with iPhone OS. But they did. Earlier, they still did some things better, and this is one of them. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that, you know, iOS was well documented, but they couldn't have started from zero with that. So this is actually one of the ways when they did it better earlier. So when they quote, key value coding is a mechanism for accessing an object's properties indirectly using strings to identify properties rather than through invocation of an accessor method or accessing them directly through instance variables. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, and Apple even has a patent on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. No one ever did this before. Well, patents don't really mean that.
No, actually, it's like all patents. There's a lot of prior art, but Apple has
a patent on it. As far as I'm concerned, it's basically two things. The first thing is it's a set of method naming conventions. And the second is something that you probably knew about, but you weren't really thinking much about, is that it's a technology, a fairly thorough technology for boxing and unboxing. Mm-hmm. So the method naming convention, pretty simple, right? It's foo for the accessor, set foo for the setter. There's actually a whole bunch of methods for dealing with arrays, which I never remember. I always have to go back to the documentation for. So it's really just foo and set foo. Basically, if you remember that, you're 90% of the way there. But of the things that you can access and set through this mechanism, there are individual objects, and there are scalars, and then there are arrays of things. So they talk about these in terms of database terminology, two-one relationships, too-many relationships, and that sort of thing. But what's interesting for me is, so objects are either considered 2-1 if they're an object which has its own properties, or are basically considered to be scalars if it's like a string, so it's basically treated like a single piece of data. But when you get things like integer and like a struct, for example, they still need to be handled through these general purpose APIs. So there's set value for key and value for key. There's the workhorse methods, everybody uses them. And even if the accessor, even if the IVAR that you're looking at is an int, for example, you still need to be able to get that value out of value for key. So out of necessity, in order to make these methods work, they need to provide a full set of boxing pieces of functionality to this. So int comes to NS integer, bool comes at NS integer. Things like NS rect get turned into an NS value. And it actually goes further than that. So this actually came a little later, but they went ahead and implemented it such that even if you have a property which is a custom struct, your own devising, no one's ever used it before, they can still box and unbox that. Did you know about this, Wolf? You probably did. Wolf?
Oh, I'm sorry. I had the mute on. That explains why you weren't talking to me. yeah, so when you... I think I did not know about that property, that custom structure serialization, boxing, unboxing. That's interesting. Also, I think when you said NS integer, I think you meant NS number.
Oh, did I say NS? Yes. Yeah, NS, the thing that comes out is always an object. So yes, the NS number and NS value are the two object types that you get with these boxing capabilities. So, okay, yeah, if I got that wrong, I appreciate mm-hmm. that. And at this point, I'm actually now thinking that there will be one moment in the podcast in every episode where one of us asks the other one something and there's silence. That's going to be like an edge cases tradition. So I think we've done two episodes in a row now. Carry on. Mm-hmm. And the way they do this is they use the, let me see, what is it? There's an NS value where they'll take just about anything as long as you tell the system what it is with the add encoding or add encode directive, whatever you call it, Objective-C directive. And I think what they must do is they must at runtime do the same thing. They must analyze the return value of a particular method or the value of a particular IVAR. And I don't know offhand if that is possible with normal runtime APIs. Do you know, Wolf, if that's...
Well, the add encode takes a type and then returns a string that represents that type that can be represented for serialization purposes.
Right, but you have to
I think all those types of runtime APIs are accessible in the OPC header files, where things like OPC message send lives. So I don't think there's any hidden APIs for that.
Right. So it's just interesting to me that they can say, you know, they'll be able to look at the method declaration and figure out its return type and do something with it, do something different with it, depending on what that return type is. That's the sort of thing that people don't normally have to worry about with Objective-C, because when you have a selector, you just, you know, foo, comma, bar, comma, baz, and you don't worry about the types. Because what you assume is that anything called foo, comma, foo, colon, bar, colon, bas, colon, there will only be one of those with a particular set of types. You want to have two different method declarations where one has, you know, the second variable, parameter is a struct versus an ID, because that really gets you into trouble.
Oh, yeah, that's the operator overloading, but the multiple overloading. And, yeah, that adds a lot of complexity real quick.
Right, right. So at least, so they got around that, and they did it entirely through methods, through runtime method implementations, which is especially interesting to me at this point because it's not what Apple seems to be doing recently. With Apple's more recent innovations are all very compiler-based. You know, when we look at how blocks work, because we talked about blocks 2 weeks ago, blocks don't require boxing and unboxing in the same way. And they can do this because you're declaring more things. The compiler is dealing more directly with the things that you work on. Whereas for key-value coding, they said, well, no, we're not going to worry about, you know, like creating a new type, creating a new kind of language construct. We're going to rely strictly with methods, and that's why they need boxing and unboxing. Because if they had said, well, you know what, we're going to have the compiler come up with an entirely new method type that can return different types of things depending on exactly what's involved, then they wouldn't have had to change everything into an ID, right?
Yeah, so it definitely feels like Apple is able to flex its muscles more. Although I guess GCC does support blocks, but again, with the entire like clean buildup thing, they also had a compiler team then. And, obviously Next and Apple has always had, you know, full-time people working on the compiler, but Apple's really poured resources into that effort of late, of the last few years. So it's almost like, you know, with the runtime stuff, is that they didn't have to do that compiler work. But now that they have this kind of compiler resource, they can do these type kind of compiler tricks.
Well, it just feels like this is a different style.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of, hey, let's do something really cool, but it's with different resources available to them, different ways of thinking about it. And it's funny, there's a bit in their documentation, which must have been added recently, where they say Objective-C's dot syntax and key-value coding are orthogonal technologies, period. Which I think is funny, is kind of their way of saying, you know, shut up about dot syntax. don't bother us with that. These are different. Don't try to make them the same thing. Though it's funny because they both use dots, right? And they both use them for kind of the same thing, but they're using them in such different ways that they really might as well have been. Well, of course, they almost certainly were written by two different teams, two different philosophies, and yet now they're both kind of smushed together. Mm-hmm. So it really feels like we're kind of getting the Perl-esque, more than one way to do it.
Nice.
And kind of the inevitable accretion of different levels of technology, sort of burying different layers of different levels of architecture under the weight of more and more development. And also, so I actually did, let me see if I don't remember the exact name of it at the moment. What did I call it? So there's going to be a new project in my GitHub that I'll put a link to in the show notes after I actually add it. And the overarching project is going to be called One Ring to Cocoa Bind Them All. yes. And underneath that will be a project called Thunderstruct. And I don't know if it was fascination or disgust with my crazy titles has actually driven me to come up with even stupider ones. In any case, in the Thunderstruct project, there's a method I put in main here, a whole bunch of uses of this KVC technology of converting arbitrary structs to NS values. And one of the things that I also put in there was the newer boxed expression calls. I added a few of those in the attempt to see if those boxed expressions would also be able to handle arbitrary structures, and they can't. So,
okay. Oh, look at you doing original research for all in the name of the podcast.
Okay, so we're like halfway in, and I haven't even gotten to bindings yet, so we'll see how this goes.
I'll shut up.
the one been talking. Okay, the second one is key value observing. There's also a key value observing programming guide, also just as useful as the coding guide was. And observing merely says, given that we've codified a standard way to get at the properties of an object. Now we'll give you a way to be notified if any of them actually change. And there's, okay, so I'm, you know, skip some of this stuff. The main thing that I get from this, now, I think you've actually said this, Wolf, and I've probably heard other people say this as well. The people who don't like cocoa bindings, which I kind of include myself in that list, often tend to say, well, okay, cocoa bindings doesn't really work that well, but KVC, KVO, well, those are good. Those are, you know, they're less complicated, less problematic. But here's a problem that I see with KVO. And the problem with KVO is that when you register to, okay, tell me about a change in a particular key path of a particular object, is that there's no, it's not like setting yourself up to getting an action. This is something I keep coming back to. When Apple set up actions, I guess this was Next, set up actions, they did it right. They said, I'm going to let you have any object connect up any method of theirs that you want to an action, so that you can call it whatever you want. And of course, in iOS, you can even give it different sets of parameters depending on exactly what you want to do. But for KVO, it all goes to an object, excuse me, to a method called observe value for key path of object change context, which is a mouthful. And what you need to do here is everything gets sent there. So if you're observing five different key paths, they all get sent to this one place, this one method. And what you have to do is basically put this big switch statement there, which says, if key path is equal to string blah, then do this. If it's equal to string blah, do this. You know, so you have to throw all this stuff in together. Now, it's not the worst thing in the world, because you can have each one of those if statements call to another method, which then does its thing. But it still seems like it's ungainly glue code.
Right, we have a dispatch mechanism built into OPSI message send already. Yeah. It's a lot faster than string comparison, hand-rolled string comparison functions.
Yes. And then the other thing I wanted to say about KVO was that the way it's implemented is interesting. It is implemented by proxy objects. And what they do is they replace your object. Let's replace your object with, what is it, Folgers crystals? That's the joke. With another object, which hands most things back to your object. But if you call the methods that it cares about, then it will do its thing before and after your method. And then, pass it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So was that still about the Folgers? Was that?
That was actually, don't they like dynamically subclass the class and then they move the ISA? Mm-hmm.
And this again was very interesting to me, because I think if they were doing it today, what they probably would have done was they would have said, well, when we're compiling your method in your object, we'll just compile in the pre and post steps into your method definition, but still make it your object. Like they would have done it at compile time rather than at runtime, I think, if they were doing it today. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Okay, so that's the first two building blocks of cocoa bindings, and now we get to cocoa binding itself. Now, there's the third technology here is something that Apple calls KVB, or key value binding, but that is not a foundation level technology. Everything from this point on is all at AppKit, and so there's no KVB programming guide. There's only cocoa bindings, and cocoa bindings programming topics is where you'll find your introduction to cocoa bindings, and again, very, very well described. And the So again, I'm wondering if there's even much of a sense to describe exactly what it is in very simple terms. You know, it's basically taking the things that we just had, a way of referring to the data in your objects in a uniform way, and then listening to the changes in those objects and that data in a uniform way, and taking that one step further and hooking that directly up to your UI widgets. And in general, that would seem like a really good idea, because you can get rid of, and they say, the reason to do this is to get rid of a lot of glue code. And so to make it easier for you to write your applications, you can write them faster, everybody wins, everybody's happy. And the ways that I've seen this work really well, the ways that I've used it, and I think, Wolf, you've talked about this, I think the way you use it as well, is if you use it for very simple cases, it can work pretty well. So one of the places where I think it works pretty well is in preferences. Because preferences often tend to be extremely simple settings, extremely simple values. So your checkboxes, text boxes, slider. You know, sliders, not really sliders, but checkboxes and radio buttons and things like that, where you're just setting very simple values. Okay, you know, send me an email when I do this. You know, what's another good example? I'm actually looking.
Like font size pop-up.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and for like for the energy saver, looking energy saver. Wake for network access, checkbox. Put hard disks to sleep when possible, checkbox. And then like computer sleep is a slider for 1 minute versus never. And so those things, Cocoa Bindings actually does really well because you can bind things pretty much, you can bind things directly to user defaults. And so I have a second application in my One Ring project called, what did I call it? Default defaults, default. And that is a little sample application with a bunch of these sorts of values that are linked to user defaults. And they're linked to user defaults through something called shared user defaults controller. And so when you're setting up a Cocoa Bindings, you need three things. You need your model object, which has the data. You need the widget. And then you need a controller in between. And Apple has a NS controller, object controller, NS controller abstract class, which sets up the infrastructure you need for this sort of thing.
Is that NS object controller?
Well, NS object controller is the concrete subclass for.
Right, right.
And then NS, the two ones that you will generally use are object controller and array controller. But the one that you use for user defaults, there's actually a user defaults controller. And what happens is, so if you want to bind something together, so I'm just going to look at this one example. And in my example, my preference is download podcasts automatically, and there's a checkbox. And so that's a checkbox widget. And then you go to Xcode, and you go to the utilities pane, and you go to the bindings inspector in the utilities pane, and it looks like a little Whirlpool thing. And the value section you bind to, and you bind to the shared user defaults controller, and that's there by default in all zibs. And you can specify in your bindings the model key path to use, and then that model key path will be your user default name. So it's in this case it's really nice because it does most of the work for you. You don't even have to set up the model object because user defaults just takes care of all of that for you. Take care of saving it to disk and everything else. So very nice. And also another one that I've used is the date picker. That's mm-hmm. also nice that it you can set that up very cleanly and very directly. The place where things get interesting, the place where things get harder is for most of the examples I've seen are master detail examples. And is that ring true for you as well, Wolf?
Yeah, definitely.
So they've got an example called NS, what is it called? NS table view binding. And if you download that, you can download that from their website. And you run it, and it's got a very simple UI for it with a table, with I think it's like a person object, whatever it's called. No, it's just a dictionary, but normally you'd probably make it like a person object, so first name, last name, phone number. And there's a couple things that are interesting here. One is that it doesn't support out of the box, but it's pretty easy to support. If you add a couple of entries, there's the list for the array of people. And there's a detail section with a first name, last name, text fields, and a phone number text field. And what you would think is, if you don't have anything selected, and when you don't have anything selected, all of the fields say no selection. So that's one thing that this NS array controller does for NS array controller does a whole bunch of things related to giving you a better UI experience. And one of them is if you don't have anything selected, it will take care of that. Because what it does for your object is it gives it a proxy, another kind of proxy, which will deal with, hey, there's no selection or there's multiple selections or anything like that. So that can be very helpful. But if I have nothing selected and these are fields that are editable, what I would expect is I could type in a new first name and a new last name and a new phone number, click the add button, and that would add a new thing. And so do you know why that doesn't work?
You don't have an object to, field has to be bound to an object that actually can be populated.
Right, because the way they set up the workflow for this, there always has to be an object. So when you say add, when you click the add button on this thing, it doesn't add a new row, which is like an object in training. It doesn't an editable object, a almost made object, an object in transition. No, it creates an actual new object with all new values set up, all new values filled in, and if you were to quit the app right then, that new object would be created and would be saved and everything else. And what I've seen in my applications that I've written is that that's almost never what I want. I want the thing where you say, okay, hit return, have a new row that is not a new object yet. It's a new object when I fill in everything. And if I don't if I delete everything and I hit return, then no new object gets created. And I'm trying to think of the UI cases where that's how it works. But that seems like the way that, again, it's the applications that I've used, they seem to work like that. So there must be some Apple applications that work like that as well. But Cocoa Bindings doesn't work like that at all. It really likes to make a new one. So if I click this add button in most kind of apps that do this, and let's say, for example, like the name has to be unique for each object I make. Well, what you'll see is, name one, name two, name three, name four, when you've got a application which is using Cocoa Bindings, because it will need to make valid objects for it every time you hit that add. And you'll only be able to set the values to what you want afterwards. Now, the way they do it with this NS table view binding example is they actually bring down a sheet which has first, last, phone number, basically a repeat of the detail view. And that kind of papers over this issue, because as long as I'm doing it in a modal sheet, that means that I'll have all these valid values for the object to input into the new object before it actually gets made, which is what you want. But it's hard to do otherwise. So let's say I type in new value. The first one with John Smith. So let's say Jane Smith, phone number 555-555-555. And so it creates a new object. And what I did was I changed the example so that it allowed multiple selection. And so if you had two different objects, one nice thing that it does is for any fields which have multiple conflicting values, it will change the text field to say multiple values in sort of this background, sort of grayer text, which can be very nice. But then you can also, if I now type in like Tom, when everything is selected, then it will change those values for all of the selected rows to Tom, this new value. And while that's kind of neat in a demo, again, that's almost never what you want in your application. So there's a lot of little details for how the UI works for this stuff that aren't really great, that aren't really what you want. You really want to be able to change this stuff. But the whole thing about Cocoa Bindings is that it's trying to do everything for you. It's trying to take care of all of the glue code, take care of all the details for you. And the trouble is, the real problem I have with Cocoa Bindings is that in any real application, what you wind up doing is putting in, after a while, as you try to get all the polish done, you put in hack after hack to get the details right with Cocoa Bindings. Up to the point where you've written more code to do these hacks than you would have written to write this thing using regular table, data source, and delegate methods to begin with. And it's harder to understand.
Yeah, I would say it's almost classified as like an attractive nuisance that when you start writing this stuff with Cocoa Bindings, it's easy for this easy stuff, but then when you hit the hard case, you're very tempted to apply the hacks you mentioned, because otherwise you're going to have to tear it all out and write all this good code.
Right. Yeah, so I have a story from my current job from very early on. So I was working on a Mac app at my current job for a while, And the code there, it was really kind of interesting. So it was written by someone there who was no longer there for other reasons. But I can't necessarily ask this person, well, you know, why did you do that? Because they're not there anymore. So I'm speculating as to motives, but I think this is what was going on. What was going on was that this person said, hey, Apple says Cocoa bindings are, you know, the shiznit. They're what you want to do. do we have a title? And so this person said, well, great, I'm going to use Cocoa bindings everywhere. The trouble is, for the app that I was working at the time, the data was not KVC compliant, as the kids say. As Apple says, actually. Apple tends to say KVO and KVC compliant quite a bit. And those, saying those are compliant means that the setter getters are of the right form, that they're called correctly. So what would happen is we would get data in ways that were not kosher. We would get data on secondary threads, for example. We would get data in fashions, again, which were just not KVC compliant. And then in order to make it work, we would pepper the Cocoa code that was sort of the glue code between this other data model and ours with will change, did change calls. And we would pepper them with those calls after the fact. And you know why that's a bad idea, Wolf?
I don't. Go ahead.
It's actually, the reason I found that it was a bad idea was because when you say add observer for a particular key path of an object, you can say, hey, I want to know what the old value was in addition to what the current value is. And so if you put the will change call after the change has actually already taken place, then that previous value is not conveyed to you properly.
Okay, I can totally see that, yeah.
And yet there was no way around this because this other code was happening, let's say, in a different library. So it was really hard to make that work. And the other reason why this didn't work for the code as we had it was that all of these changes to the data model were happening on a secondary thread. But key value observing and key value binding is all a synchronous process. So if you change something in your data model in that fashion on a secondary thread, the notification gets sent to the UI on that secondary thread. And many Cocoa widgets will do the wrong thing. They will get screwed up if you tell them to refresh themselves on the wrong thread. And so we had a lot of problems with this. Why is this table acting weird? Well, it's acting weird because you're not doing it on the main thread. And one thing that was interesting for me was that the guy that I was working with in this, who was actually a Windows developer, he had been sort of helping us set up all of this integration code. And when I told him, you know, hey, we can't do this. You gotta do a perform selector on main thread call here, because all of this bindings code, all of this mechanism to get all this stuff, this information passed around, and all these things taken care of, is not thread safe. He was dumbfounded. He was flabbergasted. How can you have a technology like this that you do all of your data work on the main thread? And I was like, that's how it is. So, you know, it made me kind of feel like, you know, I was coming to a fine dining establishment with my stone axe, right? That, the Mac can't do this stuff right. Can't do this stuff well. So that really got me thinking, you know, hey, wow. So Cocoa bindings could really use some help here, couldn't they? You know, since even if you decide that KVO and KVC are going to be synchronous, you could have set up your widgets such that, hey, I'm getting called with this, observe bindings, whatever the method is, observe value for key path. Hey, I'm getting called this on another thread. Why don't I call this on myself on the main thread? And of course, you'd have to do it asynchronously because you don't want a deadlock. And there might be other problems with that. Who knows? I haven't tried it. But that at least would have been a way to make that potentially thread safe in a fairly simple way. And the fact that no one ever really tried it, that doesn't seem to be a problem that they're interested in solving, and yet they still want to push this technique, it's a problem. And so the last thing I wanted to say was, this isn't really follow from the rest of it, but okay, the last thing I wanted to say was that when you put all this stuff together, stuff about it, it really only working for very simple table views where you don't get to choose your own polish, where you just use these default behaviors, which are often, you know, maybe not wrong, but just ill-advised in certain cases, or not what you really want, kind of makes me think that the inadvertent result of Apple attempting to give us all these technologies to make stuff easier for us is to give Mac developers the very best tools in the world to write, you know, crappy internal company apps, right? And I think the word that comes to mind is ISV for independent software vendors. Is that, am I thinking of the right term here, Wolf?
ISV tends to be kind of like like Omni software group types companies. So I, if you're talking about someone who writes internal apps, then yeah. I would not call it an ISV.
There's another term for like the kind of companies.
Like maybe an in-house developer?
Yeah, like companies that just do all these custom business logic tools for companies.
I mean, ISV could be used in that term, sure.
Because, I mean, there are a lot of companies that do that, companies that make good money doing that, because you need some developers to write your time tracking application, for example, to write your, I don't know what else, to write your ticket tracking application for a phone, like a phone service place. But these apps are never really all that polished. You know, you hire these companies to write them quickly and to write them to your specification to make them, you know, have exactly the right data in them, but you don't write them to be beautiful. And Apple, it seems what Apple wants is to have applications that are beautiful, and it wants to help developers make those. And it seems like Cocoa Bindings was kind of a miss in that respect. And so it's also especially interesting that iOS, where you would think that this would be really, the idea of Cocoa Bindings would be really useful, because you've got kind of the greatest collection of noobs that Apple has ever seen coming to their platform. You know, people who don't know development at all, people who don't know Cocoa development at all, you know, rushing to their platform to make apps and, you know, make them quickly and get them on the App Store. It would seem that this is the kind of thing that you would want. You'd want technology to take care of all this glue code. And yet, of course, Cocoa Bindings does not exist on iOS. And have you heard anything about why it doesn't exist on iOS?
I have not heard officially one way or another. I assume it's because Cocoa Bindings is kind of a failure.
That actually... Yes, so that's actually putting it in more prosaic terms than I was hoping, maybe a little juicier gossip there. So yeah, basically what little birdies have told me is that, you know, there's basically internal resistance to putting it on iOS. And it's kind of, you know, we don't want what would be a good analogy here. You know, we don't want, you know, the broken down pickup, you know, parking on our street where otherwise we have Ferraris, for example.
Okay, that's interesting. I was going to go with a fungus analogy.
fungus, all right. All right, I think either way works. Cocoa Bindings as a fungus. There we go. Okay, so I think that's pretty much what I have on that. You have any more comments?
Yeah, two things. Number one, I want to say the phrase KVOMI. That way it could be potentially titled. The other thing is that there seems to be like this stack of suck where it's like, you know, KVC and KVO, yes. and then the Cocoa Bindings. And KVC itself is really pretty good. I mean, I have a bunch of problems with it, but overall it does a job that's advertised to do.
Well, it's also very
KVO
simple.
Has a yeah. new another set of problems on top of it. And you mentioned that basically the threading problems are, the API is problematic, the threading problems are even more problematic. Yes. But it's still tractable. A lot of people have written these like secretarial type of objects that, you know, take the KVO observation messages, and then they can forward and do the right thing to forward it to the right object on the right thread. And I'm sorry. That should not secretarial. It's a receptionist pattern. I think that was at a WWDC presentation. And finally, Coco Bonnie's just like, stay away from it. So this, like, as you go higher, the suck gets worse.
Okay. Actually, one thing that I had written down, but I didn't mention. So we had talked previously about aggregation methods, where you could use, like, you can use blocks for with certain methods, so that, like, a visitor pattern. So you apply the method in the block, the code in the block, to each object in a collection, for example.
Right. Yeah.
There are actually limited number of collection operators in, is it KVC?
That's KVC. Yeah.
And someone actually brought this up. Someone tweeted about this, for example. But like at count is an operator that you could add on to an array of numbers such that it would count up those numbers, I believe.
Yeah, I always get confused because I always want to put the at sum or at min or at max like after the key, but you actually should do it before the key in right. Your key value path.
Yeah, I mean, the syntax is a little weird. And also, I mean, it's kind of a opportunity loss because they specifically say in the documentation, hey, we have a couple of keys that do some interesting stuff with this, but there's no way for you to add your keys to it. So you can't make this a general purpose visitor pattern collection aggregator thing because it only does a couple of things.
Yeah, that's true. There is a project called OGNL, Object Graph Navigation Language, that was real popular with the WebObjects crowd that is basically like key value coding paths on steroids, and I think you could even call your own methods and all that, and yeah, so that we probably should link that to the show notes.
Oh, cool. That'd be great. So, okay. So, we're done otherwise. Please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And you can find us on Twitter, me, Apontius, APONTIOUS, which is also my username on app.net, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench. That's the word rent, R-A-N-T, plus Z, plus S-C-H. And we'll see you next time. Actually, we'll see you in 4 weeks.
Which is still technically next time.
True enough.